Once more under the breach, dear friends.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And if today is the 16th of February where you are of the year 2019, you're certainly welcome to give us a call at 254-773-1400. You can also reach us at either Jeff or Jake at tpwc.com. That's thepersonalwealthcoach.com, and we will try to respond to those as well. The Personal Wealth Coach is not only a radio program that is riveting in the sense that it gives you a great deal of pain when the hot, red-hot rivets are stuck into your skin, but it's also
very riveting.
Yes, very riveting. But it's also the name of a registered investment advisor in Salado, Texas, a fiduciary organization called the Personal Wealth Coach that, not by coincidence, has the same two principals, Jeff and
Jake
McClure. See, we can do that.
Occasionally.
Yes. And we are regulated by the United States Securities and Exchange Commission. That's who you make complaints to if you want to make complaints. And the information we provide on here, though, is not investment advice. It is educational in nature and should not be acted on in your investments. Investment advice is given based on individual circumstances. Let's see, what else? The information we provide on here is, we believe to be, from sources we believe to be reliable and accurate, things like the Wall Street Journal, Financial Times, Barron's, things of that ilk. And we make every effort to see to it that it is accurate and timely, but we make no guarantees that the information we present here is such, so, and thereby.
Yeah, all that good stuff.
Yeah. And we have a caller on 773-1400 that was rapid. So, caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. Thank you. I just wanted to ask you this question so you can get at your business at hand. When the U.S. Mint stamps out these coins and some of them have a defect on them, and then they get out into circulation out in the public, and then they want tens and thousands of dollars for these coins that were misprinted, how does that happen? Is that illegal for these coins to be printed by the U.S. Mint, and then people get a hold of them out here and try to sell them for all these outrageous prices? You have a good day, sir.
Well, appreciate the call.
Coin collectors are called numismatists. I think that's a neat word. If you could pronounce it, you can be a coin collector. And the fact that the Mint occasionally makes a misstrike on a coin, and then doesn't catch it as it goes out and it gets into the public before, those are very, very rare, and that's what makes them valuable. And the contrary, I mean, the Mint and the Treasury love it when that happens, when people go to collect currency, because they print the currency, and if people didn't just hang on to it, they don't have to replace it. It becomes more valuable, and it's, you know, it's basically worth more to the Mint when you do that. Now, there is a problem that they've run into, though, in that area. Now, I think this is a little strange. People saving pennies, because it costs more than a cent to manufacture a penny in the United States. And people have a tendency to take their pennies and throw them in a jar or something and fill up a jar with pennies. And so that actually causes a loss to the Treasury, not a very big one in the overall scheme of things.
They had to make a law to that effect, as a matter of fact.
Really?
Because people were taking the pennies and melting them down for the copper and then selling the copper. You're allowed to melt down pennies, but only for artistic or free speech purposes. You can't use them for some kind of monetary gain.
But they stopped making them out of copper some time ago.
Yeah, it's a zinc core.
So now you melt them down and you get something that's not worth very much. But, you know, and I personally would love to see the penny done away with. It would be less stuff rattling around in my pocket. And it costs us money. It costs us more than a cent to print a cent. So we should get rid of it, considering that the cent is now worth what we used to call a mill, which was a tenth of a cent. Back when I was a kid, inflation has caused the value of money to drop by 10 times during that time period. So why don't we just get rid of the pennies and round off to the nearest nickel? But every time that's been tried, I don't know who it is that lobbies against pennies being eliminated, but there's a lot of lobby that runs up against that. There's a lot of objection against it.
Yeah, and it's not really formal objections, it's just objections. At some point, the penny's going to go away.
Well,
that big question, though, is it's not illegal. Please consult with an attorney. But it is not illegal to charge more for any dollar. If you have a dollar bill that is in some way significant to you, your great uncle gave it to you on your trip to Disneyland, you're allowed to charge whatever you want for that dollar.
Mm-hmm. And you could have an old silver certificate, which are technically worth, if it's in mint condition, a silver certificate is worth more than a dollar.
Right. But if you go to the store and you want to buy something with it, it's going to be worth $1.
And you, for instance, can buy from the United States government $20 gold coins that are worth
significantly more than $20.
Hundreds and hundreds of dollars, and you pay hundreds and hundreds of dollars for them. And you'll sell them, if you were to sell them, you'd sell them for hundreds of dollars, but they're still a $20 gold coin. So the Mint actually does print a few gold coins and sells them to the public for way more than the $20 it says on there. You know, if you had an old actual silver dollar, and there's still, people still have a few silver dollars laying around here and there and collect them, obviously, it's worth a lot more than a dollar, I'll tell you that. And so, yeah, there's no law against money being worth more than it's worth.
All right. Here's a piece of news. You're about to go into the market issues stuff, but I'm going to do – a record was broken last year.
What kind of record?
It was not the vinyl kind. Those would, you break it, you buy it, and they don't make very many of them anymore.
Okay.
So it's probably not a good idea. But the record was Texas produced – more oil last year, 2018, than it ever has before, ever. It produced 1.54 billion barrels of oil. It passed the record.
That's a lot of oil.
Yeah, that's, the previous record was in 1973. It was 1.28 billion. So 1.54, that's like a quarter of a billion barrels more produced last year than the record number. And this is a weird statistic because it loses its meaning in a moment, but you'll understand. If Texas were a country, it would be the fourth largest oil producer after the USA, Saudi Arabia, and Russia. However, if Texas were a country, USA would be behind Texas. So it would be, Texas is the major producer of oil and gas in the United States. So it would go, it would be the third largest producer of oil in the world, Russia, Saudi Arabia, and Texas.
Which is one of the main reasons, by the way, we do not have an income tax in Texas.
Right. There's
an oil cum tax.
Hundreds of billions of dollars from the oil industry goes to support the Texas government. And saying that, last year we passed up Iraq and Iran for oil production in Texas. So that's just a fascinating microcosm of history, and I didn't see it reported. There were other bigger pieces of news to report since the end of last year, so I didn't want to throw that in there and say, hey, we're energy independent for a reason.
And I love Texas, and I'm from Texas, and I root for Texas, and I'm truly a Texan. But I also recognize there's a little irony in which we attract so many businesses and we're attracting people into Texas. And one of the big things is we have low taxes and good highways and good education and a good higher education system. And all three of those are a direct result of having been a state with a lot of greasy, dead dinosaurs and plants.
And plants, yeah.
Little tiny
things, yeah.
And figuring out very innovatively how to get it out of the ground. You really can't knock another state who doesn't have great quantities of oil to pump out of the ground. And interestingly enough, it works out very well. Other states have oil. Pennsylvania is where it was first discovered and commercially produced. The problem is a lot of the oil in Pennsylvania is in urban or well-settled areas and throwing up lots of big oil rigs in the middle of populated areas is not exactly the most popular thing to do, and people don't want to do that.
Now, Pennsylvania is not really on the map as far as oil production anymore, but it is the second largest producer of liquid natural gas in the country, which people don't think of Pennsylvania when they think of liquid natural gas. You would think, what is that, North Dakota? Oklahoma? Well, no, it's Pennsylvania followed by Alaska. Well, Texas, Pennsylvania, and Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
And then Louisiana and Oklahoma.
But
Texas produces
what I was trying to say is Texas has its oil mainly, not in East Texas where there's a lot of crops and there's a lot of people,
right,
but in the middle of West Texas where there's a lot of effectively nothing.
Right. So it's...
makes it easier to get to.
Easier to get to. You don't have to drill through somebody's house or shake their house around a lot while you're drilling. Yeah, so that was a nice little piece of information to throw out there. I haven't heard that reported anywhere except for just in the oil and gas publications.
And we have another caller on 773-1400, so you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead. Hello.
You guys enjoy the show. Saw in the Wall Street Journal the head of the San Francisco Fed says no more rate increases this year. So what do you guys think about that, and how does that impact the economy? Thank you.
All right. Good call. Good question.
The head of the San Francisco Fed has exactly one vote. And so while I would say, based on what we know at the moment, I wouldn't be at all surprised that was true. On the other hand,
I actually don't think that the San Francisco Fed has a vote.
They don't have a Fed.
She doesn't have a vote. She's a non-voting member of the board.
Okay.
She's making a statement there, and I can look that up again. I can look up the actual story, but I don't believe the San Francisco Fed has a vote
this year. I know they rotate.
It's a rotating. Okay, the votes go in those nominated by the president and consented by the Senate have a vote. And then they rotate the heads of the different districts through the voting areas. I think the New York Fed always has a vote, but I'm not positive on that. Anyway, what she said was basically there's too many headwinds, political and otherwise, that we should just assume that there's not going to be any rate hikes. But it goes against all of the people that have spoken recently that do have votes.
You also need to remember that just a couple of months ago, just about everybody on the Fed said we're probably going to have two rate hikes in 2019, and now she's saying none. It could switch back just as quickly. Let me give you a little scenario. If, for example, the president declared victory in the trade war and dropped off tariffs against China, and China reciprocated, and the threat of 25% tariffs on automobiles, which is also hanging out there, a universal 25% tariff on automobiles imported from Europe or Asia, were to go away. If all that were to go away at once, I strongly suspect we would see a sudden rise in the market, a drop in interest rates, and a rise in interest rates, a whole series of things occur, including a vigorous kick in the rear end for the economy, and we might get some inflation. At that point, the Fed could raise interest rates.
All right. I just wanted to clarify this. Now I've looked it up, and it was correct. I had read something months ago on it. But she had a vote in December and doesn't get another vote till 2021. So she doesn't get a real say in whether interest rates go up this year or next year.
It is her opinion, sitting on the Federal Reserve Board, that there probably won't be any votes this year. I mean, any raises this year in the interest rates. And that's if everything continues on as we just saw for 30 days, I don't think there's any question about that. On the other hand, what we just saw over the last 30 days in the way of economic information could be a blip. And we have another caller on 254-773-1400. So, caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Good morning. I don't know if you guys are prepared or have time to discuss this, but someday, and maybe it's now, I'd like to hear your discussion of the impacts on the economy if the Green New Deal that the Democrats have floated out there, or not floated, they've actually written it down, were to go into effect. and what impacts it would have on the U.S. economy. So all I'll right. sit back and let you talk about it.
Okay. I think we'll hit that later in the program for sure. When you ask the question,
well, it's a big one.
I started smiling because it's politics, and it definitely politics writ large. The Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is forcing a floor vote in the Senate on this. And the Democrats are rather upset with that because the vast majority of the Democrats will not vote for it. It is not going to pass because of exactly the question you're asking. The impact on the economy would be
unpleasant. Let's simply say
unpleasant may be an understatement.
You know, and if they were to say by 2050 or 2060, which is basically the kind of thing that's going on in the European Union, if we would say that we would reduce our carbon footprint significantly over a period of time, yeah, that could easily fly. But for starters, the technology is not there to do what they want to do.
Right, and this is the key point. This is from two economists sitting here. This is the key point. Every generation can look back at the previous generation and say they were doing something abysmal, something horrible that we would never agree to today. And if you think about what that might be, if you think whether that's civil rights or you think back a few generations before that to slavery, this is not a PC subject at all. But if you think about the subject of slavery, slavery goes back to before human history. Prehistory had slavery. We've got lots of evidence of that. You have a degree in cultural anthropology. You can vouch for this. Slavery goes back since humans have been around. And there have always been people that were anti-slavery. In Rome, there were anti-slavery supporters that were very, very willing to give large amounts of money. Spartacus was supported by senators of Rome. Spartacus was an escaped slave. So why is it that it took till the 19th century to get rid of slavery in what we consider the developed world? There's still slavery that exists in the world, by the way. And it didn't go away until we had technology to replace it. It didn't go away because the government put taxes on it. They did. It didn't go away because the government restricted the transport. They did. It didn't go away from all of these measures that the carbon or the Green New Deal are trying to do, a governmental action, because there's nothing there to replace it yet. We had the McCormick Reaper, and that was what allowed us to take the ethical route. The Roman Empire was built on slavery. The Egyptian pyramids were built by slaves. If you look at the wall in China, that was slavery. All of these big things were slavery. But then you look at the big achievements that have happened in the 20th century and the 21st, the national highway system, not just in the United States, but all over the world, was not a slavery thing.
It wasn't.
Is that amazing or what? The railroad was not completed in the 19th century with slavery. We had technology that came along that allowed everyone to get on the same ethical page. And when we're talking about carbon emissions, the role of the government should be encouraging technological production, not in penalizing people unless there's an alternative to what they're already doing. There's been a big shift to liquid natural gas and natural gas as a less carbon emitting thing, and the petroleum industry is the first to stand on a pedestal and tell you about the reduced carbon footprint. This is the petroleum industry. There's a little bit of irony in that statement, but the reason why so much of our power production has moved away from coal to natural gas isn't because of carbon. It's because liquid natural gas is a lot cheaper than coal. It also happens to be a lot cleaner, so it's like everything going well for it.
And it's in the interest of pollution. We're no longer in the United States allowed to just recklessly pollute the air. So if you're burning coal, you have a back-end cost on the coal, and it's
right.
pretty high to get rid of the ash in an environmentally safe fashion. and to get rid of the stuff that comes out of the smokestack in an environmentally safe fashion.
And at the beginning, in the coal mine, to mine the coal in a human-safe fashion, without black lung, without collapses, and you hear about collapses in coal mines all over the world with dozens of people trapped and killed. If that were to happen in the United States, it would mean the absolute end of the coal industry, because over time, because of technology, we have put a much higher value on human life.
And we, by the way, and if you watch the trains go through the Killeen Temple area, you recognize that there's these huge coal trains, and they have nothing to do with jazz, that come from the West. The big coal production is no longer in the Appalachians. The big coal production is in Wyoming now, where they in strip mines. But the point is, with regard to the Green New Deal, very frankly, that is going to appeal to relatively radical purist, I don't know what to call that political group, but the people who...
They claim to be socialists, but it's not really socialism.
They're not really socialists. But there's a group of people who are deeply concerned about something. And it is, and by the way, it is the mirror image of the people who are deeply concerned about the wall. You've got a group of people in the United States who are deeply concerned about illegal immigration and want to build a wall no matter how much it costs and no matter how, frankly, absurd some of the concepts are surrounding building a wall across Texas, including the grabbing of huge quantities of private property, or else cutting the owners off from their private property. The estimates that I've read for building the wall across Texas aren't $5.7 billion.
No, we're talking $70 billion.
$70 billion. And all the studies have strongly indicated all that will happen is we'll just get a lot of people in boats going across the Gulf of Mexico. But the issue is, either side of the political spectrum has a tendency to focus on a narrow issue, and that narrow issue has a powerful effect on the primaries, because those are the people who go out and vote in the primaries. On the left, it's going to be probably two major issues. One is Medicare for all, and the other one is the Green New Deal. And on the right, it's the wall. And so they're the equivalent. They're each equivalent areas. They're symbolic of something that people want to stand for and want to believe in.
It's a principle issue.
Right.
It's a very strongly held principle issue, and they're very different issues from each other, but they have the same kind of, I feel like we should do something.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing that they're saying. We need to do something, and we haven't done something.
And we need
so
somebody else to pay
it.
For it.
Right, and somebody else needs to pay for it. And the Green New Deal, it's basically anybody that's not voting for this is going to be paying for it.
You know,
and with the wall, we still haven't determined who's going to pay for the wall. It looks like the debate has definitely moved away from Mexico paying for the wall to how are we paying for it congressionally or through a state of emergency. Economic impact.
There's a beautiful irony coming up. The argument about the debt ceiling, which is closing in and no one's paying any attention to. We do not have a bill raising the debt ceiling yet.
We also don't have an extension on the 25% tariffs starting March 1st with China.
But talk about the wall. The same people, this is what's ironic. I mean, this is so dripping with irony, it's almost funny.
I think it's sardony, almost irony.
The people in Congress, the Freedom Caucus, that is universally for immediately appropriating enough money to build the whole wall, are the same people who said they will not vote to raise the debt ceiling, but they also won't vote to raise taxes to pay for the wall.
So
now, if you want to follow that logic through, you hit a brick wall really quickly.
I'm not sure people understand our position on the wall. From our perspective, if we can find a way to pay for the thing, it seems like an expensive project. It seems like there's, if we look at infrastructure issues, if we look at prisons that need to be built, if we look at a lot of other things, I would think even including continuing to retool the military, I would think there are better uses for the money. But part of being in a representative democracy, this is what is influencing our opinion, is working with people who have the same goals that disagree on some of the other goals. If building the wall will make a large portion of the United States feel more comfortable, even if the feeling isn't backed right now by any numbers that we can find, if it makes them feel more comfortable, okay, let's figure out how to pay for it. We've done a lot of things in the United States that are just to keep everybody kind of happy, even if we disagree about it a little bit. So that's where I am with the wall. I don't think the wall will be effective in stopping illegal immigration. I don't think just because we see where the illegal immigrants are coming.
I've got a proposal, and I have not received exactly, well, I don't know, maybe one vote, Jake's vote, in support of this. But I've got a proposal, and every time I say it to somebody, they look really like they just bit into something sour. No problem. If it's going to cost about $70 billion to build the wall, first let's recognize it. If you're going to pay for the land that the government takes away from people in Texas.
That's called eminent domain. It's in the Constitution.
And there's some big chunks of land that will be cut off by the if we build the wall straight across the shortest route across the southern border of Texas. If we're going to pay the people for the land and we're going to build a decent wall across Texas, fine, let's do it. Very simply, at the same bill that says build the wall, says raise everybody's taxes pro rata. Basically, whatever tax you're paying, you get a percent add-on to whatever your bottom line. You owe the government this much money. Guess what? Pay 5% more. A 5% surcharge over a 5 or 10-year period, and we could pay for the wall. Now, if you want to build a wall, and you say, but I don't want my taxes to go up,
then you got to figure out how to build the wall without paying for it.
Borrowing it is
not a long-term solution. The Mexicans are not going to pay for it.
Well, borrowing it simply says, let's have our grandkids pay for it.
We're
going to build a wall and have our kids.
We're financing the debt that we have right now, $1.3 trillion in debt for 1 year. That's the deficit for last year. We've financed that in the short term. If we're talking about tacking more on there, I don't.
Did you say moron?
I did. And by the way, we are absolutely not in agreement with the Democrats in Congress on their approach to this either. So it puts us in a place where we feel like both sides really dislike us at the moment. But the reality is that we're not looking at it from campaign promises or slogans, or we have to look at numbers. We have to look at statistics. We have to look at where are the illegal immigrants coming from? Where are they being captured? What is the crime rate? And these are all numbers that are published by the FBI. You can look them up yourself. That's the thing. Look them up. If you don't agree with the media, and there's a lot of fake news out there on the right and the left, look up the numbers, because the FBI is sworn to say the truth in those numbers. They can be fired and go to jail for lying purposefully in these numbers. That's a pretty big, important factor in determining where you get your news and what numbers are correct. Man, we talked about a lot of stuff that had nothing to do with the market. We haven't even covered the market
while yet. While we're there, and I think it is important to note, the fourth quarter federal receipts, the receipts for last year in general, I think we're down like 1.4% over the previous year.
Yeah.
Despite the fact that the government, the economy was going great, was booming all last year, in a manner like we have not seen since the 1990s, maybe even more than the 1990s. But despite the tremendous amount of economic activity, the tax cut did result in a reduction of government revenue, and we also passed a $300 billion increase in spending, which was needed, by the way, I think, for the military. But our point is very simple. If you want to give $300 billion to the military to upgrade its systems, which they needed, then charge us extra across the country. There's, very frankly, that's not that much per person across the country. Raise our taxes and we fund the military.
We seem to be stuck on these two big debates, the wall, the Green New Deal, these two really opposing arguments. What happened to budget constraints? Newt Gingrich's pay-as-you-go. If you don't have a revenue-neutral spending bill, then you can't pass it. That's gone. And that really disappoints me, because this is we've got a long term to look at, and that's our job, is to look long term. And we have a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hey, I'm sorry, I called and asked about the new Green Deal. Sorry about that. One more question. When was the last time that Congress actually passed a budget?
They did one a year and a half ago. They're doing continuing resolutions, and the continuing resolution is the budget that's been cut into chunks. So they take different departments and fund them at different rates. And just as an example of that, with the changes that have been made at the VA is funded 2 years in advance. So that if we have a budget problem and the government gets shut down, the veterans don't suddenly stop receiving medical care. So there's different parts of the government that are funded in different budgets, but the Constitution says that the Congress is supposed to come up with a budget every year. Just as a side note, this is on that same subject, the process is the executive branch, the president, submits a budget. And the budget is derived from all of the departments that are the executive branch. They come in and say, this is how much we would like. The executive branch looks at it. The president says, all right, this is what we want. We then hands it off to Congress. And that's at the beginning of the fiscal year,
right,
for the next fiscal year. So I cannot find anywhere in the history of the United States that the president's proposed budget was accepted by Congress. It's not there. So that's never happened. In the middle of that, the president's last proposed budget only included $1.67 billion for the wall. So that was part of my problem with the government shutdown during a Republican Congress, is that the president only requested $1.67 from Congress, almost got 23, but backed out of it, then shut down the government because he didn't get 5.6. This bad leadership. That is not clear messaging. So Congress is supposed to then turn around and do a full-on budget. And then the last one we did was a year and a half ago, but before that was probably 8 or 9 years of no budget.
Yeah.
Well, but we are currently operating under the 2018 fiscal year budget that was passed by Congress.
Right.
Let's see.
But it was passed in
March 22nd.
Yeah.
We passed a $1.3 trillion spending bill last year. That's part of the deal that where the tax cut occurred, and then we raised spending for the military. That was actually the budget passed by Congress.
The problem with the budget that was passed by Congress, so you asked when was the budget passed, is that it wasn't the complete budget. They haven't been doing full governmental complete budget that covers everything. I don't know when the last time was. And part of that comes because there are self-funding organizations in there. Go ahead.
I'm looking right here. There's a whole series of articles, but Congress finally passes fiscal year 2018 federal budget on March 23rd. Now, the fiscal year began on October 1st. They passed it on March 23rd. So we had a 2018 fiscal budget, we don't have a 2019 fiscal budget.
And the 2019 fiscal budget, which was being passed in, I think they were in seven stages with 16 different departments being split across them, it was in the fourth stage, and I'm trying to remember from articles that I've read in the past, that the government shutdown happened in. So that's why part of the government was still funded. They're not consolidating their budget anymore.
I need to make an appointment with you guys and come in and see how I can fund my family budget in a similar fashion. You know, if the if I could wait 6 months for my budget and know what I spent those first 6 months, I'd probably hit my budget more often.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's what we help with. That is part of the reason why we get so disappointed with Congress is, come on, people know how to do this. It really isn't rocket surgery. It just takes some education. And if you know any rocket surgeons, have them give me a call, because
that's right.
It's a high-demand position.
Actually,
got a guy that welds on rockets, but I don't think I'd call him a surgeon.
Oh, okay. Close enough,
right,
though.
Thanks
for the call.
Right, bye.
Bye.
So there is an omnibus bill, and there are pieces of it tracking through the House right now for the 2019 budget, which is a little bit – right now what they keep doing is a continuing resolution to fund it at last year's level. But there actually are efforts to pass the budget through Congress, and they seem to be moving forward. Now
– and sequestration lasted, what, 6 years? I'm not sure exactly the number of years, but basically it was a compromise, not compromise, that basically said we're not doing a lot of things, but didn't really say what we were doing. We've got another caller on 773-1400. Caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is JB. Am I live? Am I on?
You are live.
I think
you're live. Check your pulse.
Check your pulse. Are you breathing?
Last time I checked.
Okay.
All right, good.
Talking politics, and I want to talk that a little bit, but I want to know how it's going to impact my investment.
Okay.
I'm getting at a point to where I want to start investing a substantially larger portion of my income, and plus for tax reasons, I need to open an IRA. But since we haven't had a budget surplus, actually a budget, a real budget, because a budget means you send less out than you take in, since Bill Clinton was president, and he hadn't been president in a long time.
Yeah, I guess it is. He did.
Year 2000.
Yeah. That was just the other day.
That still seems like the future to me.
A few weeks back, yeah. I understand, but all these politicians now are not worried about, in my opinion, and I'm one of the bad guys probably, they're not worried about doing their job. They're worried about getting reelected.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Donald J. Trump was elected based on the fact that he was, one of the main reasons that he wasn't a politician. But yet, when he got there, he learned if he didn't play the game that he couldn't do anything. So now he's like just as bad as the rest of them.
Who are you talking about?
Donald J. Trump.
Oh, Donald J. Trump.
Yeah, the commander in chief, president of the United States. Yeah,
wait, who is he again? Who is he again?
Well, he's a guy that went bankrupt several times in his personal business. So that ought to tell you something, but. You know, we don't judge them based on moral fiber or past decisions. But, you know, I'm with you guys. I travel our great southwestern border on a regular basis. There's some places that wall, from an engineering standpoint, is going to be impossible to construct. And, you know, I think the way to solve that problem would, the people wouldn't be coming here if they were not wanted here.
Yeah, we're paying them.
People want them for different reasons. But if you actually went... follow the money. Go after the money. The people that are the contractors that are hiring them to work, if you go after them and you charge them a severe penalty and you make the people coming in pay to be here. You want to come here and work, you know, you have to pay a surcharge. You're not going to pay Social Security and federal income tax.
Oh, yeah, but you do.
They do.
They do pay Social Security and...
Exactly. I think, but, you know, they should have to pay to be here if they don't want to become an American citizen. My opinion. Because... you know, you can build all the fences and walls and prisons you want. If people still want them here, they're going to get them here. And as far as the criminals and the drug dealers and the gangs, maybe I'm pessimistic, have the wrong attitude, but those guys are making so much money off of that product that they're bringing here, they're going to find a way to get it here.
Yeah, El Chapo just had his trial, and... he didn't go across the border. He was using submarines and airplanes and yachts, and there were no tunnels or railway cars or mule trains across the desert.
You wanted to know how it's going to affect your investments. Let me simply say
that I was wanting to ask.
It isn't. There's your answer.
It isn't.
Okay. No, the number of people who crossed the border. Now, if you'd asked this in 1990, that might have been a different answer. But today, the number of people who come into the United States and go to work or do whatever they do, who actually cross the Rio Grande to do so, are such a tiny portion of what used to and such a tiny portion of our economy that it's really pretty insignificant. And we've talked about this before. The surveys are a little dated now, but even, and I think it's a bigger number now, but over 80% of the people who are in the country illegally came in through airports.
And
they came in with a visa, with a tourist visa, or with an agreement. You know, a lot of places you don't have to have a visa to fly into the United States. And they just stayed. And as we have increased the security on the border with more Border Patrol and arresting more people and making better jobs in Mexico, the Mexicans have pretty much stopped coming to the United States. Now, that is a real shock to some people. The people who come to the United States right now, by the way, illegal across the border, the people that the wall is all about and everything else, is people who are fleeing violence and persecution in their home countries and want safety. It's that simple. They want someplace where they can live, where their children won't be taken off and made into soldiers, or they won't be forced to be peddling drugs, or and they won't be subject to the gangs that rule many places in Central America right now. And very frankly, the wall's not going to stop them, because the people who bring them across will just put them in boats. Then what are we going to do? And I've asked this question. If we build a wall along the Texas border, that won't even slow things down, because Europe has the same immigrant problem that we do. And Europe has water. They have the Gulf of Mexico, not Gulf of Mexico.
How'd they get that?
They have the Mediterranean. They have the Mediterranean Sea between them and North Africa, where the immigrants are coming from, and they still coming across. There are solutions to this, and we did, I think, a great solution with the Matadoras, the factories just across the border as part of NAFTA. We've set up factories. We allowed that a company in the United States could set up factories just across the border in a buffer zone and assemble vehicles and things like that. And then when the product comes over, there'd be no tariff on it. And as a result, instead of coming to the United States to get jobs, the Mexicans stayed in Mexico and worked. And it has worked extremely well. And I think there's probably other solutions. But that's, if you want a wall, fine. Somebody wants a wall, fine. No problem.
Figure out how to pay for it.
Just be willing to just simply volunteer to pay 5% more on your taxes until the wall is paid for.
Now, there was a big movement, GoFundMe movement, where a lot of people were putting money away for it. But the problem is that the Constitution says that if you're allowed to donate money to the U.S. Treasury, that there's nobody going to stop you from doing that. The U.S. government will thank you. I'll thank you. But you can't put a string on it and say you got to use it for one thing and one thing only, because
that's
not part of the law. All right. Well, we got to talk some other market stuff, and we've got some commercials to play, and we're almost done with the hour. So thank you very much, sir, for the call.
Where do I need to go to open a good IRA? You guys?
There's a lot of places to do research on that. Vanguard is a good place to start. They are owned by their investors, and they have kind of across the board some really low expenses. You can look at American funds. You can look at USAA if you qualify. The big thing to do is do your research as far as expenses, because they're going to have different expenses across the board. You could start at E-Trade. There's a lot of places you can go to do this. The problem then becomes deciding on which one. And if you want to give us a call, we can talk to you about it and get you pointed in the right direction. But it's a bigger question than just where do I go?
In your professional opinion, you don't think that this bubble's going to pop? Because
what bubble is it that you're – what bubble are you referring to?
United States economy, the world economy, because we cannot continue to spend more than we take in. And eventually, somebody's got to pay the debt. Eventually, China's going to run out of money to give us.
Right. Okay. Well, that's a good question. And I think we'll probably spend some time on that either later this hour or next hour, because that's a good question, and it's one that is more than you want to hear the answer to that.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
And thanks for the call.
Pay your bills, man.
All right. Take care. All right. Well, we got to play some commercials, and we'll be back. We got to update you on what happened in the market this week. We haven't even done our...
We only have 9 minutes left in the hour.
So we're going to play some commercials. We'll be back on the other side. If you have questions, the phone number in here is 254-773-1400. This is the Personal Wealth Coach, and we'll be right back.